talks about in book 11, page 698. Line 990, the whole passage is full of this prophecy, but I will take a few passages. Line 990, about 8-9 lines from the bottom. Now will I do in thee my marvelous works. I will fasten thy nature with my cords of strength, subdue to my delight thy spirit's limbs, and make thee a vivid knot of all my bliss, and build in thee my proud and crystal home. That thy day shall be my shafts of fire and light, thy nights my starry mysteries of joy, and all my clouds lie tangled in thy hair, and all my springtides marry in thy mouth. O sunward, thou shalt raise the earth soul to light and bring down God into the lives of men. Earth shall be my work chamber and my house, my garden of life to plant a seed divine. When all thy work in human time is done, the mind of earth shall be a home of light, the life of earth a tree growing towards heaven, the body of earth a tabernacle of God. Bring God down into the lives of men. This is something to be understood. Bring God down into the lives of men. You see, there are various manifestations of God. We already are a manifestation of God. The animals are a manifestation of God. The trees are a manifestation of God. Minerals, rocks, they are also a manifestation of God, because according to the spiritual tradition to which we belong, nothing exists here which is not God. There is nothing here which is not God. Show me one thing which is not God. You know the famous story that a king said, asked his, you know, I have not mentioned this story for a long, long time, so maybe should briefly mention it. He asked the pandits in his court, who is greater, me or God? Sometimes kings ask this question. Now the pandits didn't know what to say. In those days these pandits were called Brahmins. These days Brahmins have no punditry left. Who is greater, God or me? Well, the best, easiest thing is to say you, because the king would like to hear that, but then he will ask, give me a reason why you think I am greater than God. Is it simply trying to butter me up? Is it muscification, as we call it in Indian English? So they didn't know what to say, but many of the Brahmins said, how can we tell a lie? We must tell the truth, and we know God is greater than everybody. So they thought the best thing would be to leave this kingdom and go to a neighboring kingdom. This king will not let us be in peace. So they had taken time for 7 days, and at the end of the beginning of the seventh day, early in the morning, they all started packing up their pots and pans and clothes, etc., for an exodus to the next kingdom. Then one of their senior people, elderly men, was awakened. He was sleeping. He said, what is it you are doing? Because they were hiding this from that man, because they said it is a retired man, useless man, etc., will be of no use for us. So they had not told him this. He said, where are you going? What do you want to do? Then they said, Grandpa, this is the calamity we are facing. He said, is that all? Leave it to me. I will find a solution for it. They couldn't just believe their ears, but he said, no, look, I have faced similar situations in the past. Leave it to me. You don't have to pack and leave this place. And you know the story goes. Next, at the end of the 7 days, the whole delegation went to the king, and the king, of course, twirling his mustache or whatever he had, he asked, who is greater, me or God? And the old man said, sir, of course you. What do you mean, I am greater than God? Is there any good reason for saying this? Of course, he said, there is a good reason. What is the reason? He said, sir, you can banish us from your kingdom, but God can never banish us from his kingdom. So where exists the end of God's kingdom? Everything is God's kingdom. So in this sense, everything is God. But then there is a degree of manifestation of God. Schumacher, the great author of The Small is Beautiful and so on, he has written an interesting book called The Philosophy for the Perplexed. He says philosophers are busy answering questions nobody has, and they can't answer questions which everybody has. If you ask them about love and God and patriotism, etc., I say don't ask these questions, we don't know answers to these questions. They are only worried about truth value of propositions and so on. What is truth value of propositions? They are doing this. So he said the modern philosophy is quite confusing, quite useless. So I will write a new philosophy. So he has written a little book called Philosophy for the Perplexed. And in that book, he is not by any means a devotee, etc. He is a hard-headed economist. You know, he was the advisor to the British Coal Board. And the British Coal Board is one of the most pragmatic of bodies, and British, of course, are the peak of pragmatism. So it is the headquarters of pragmatism. And he was the advisor to the headquarters of British pragmatism. He writes in that book that if you look at this whole world, you will see that the world has gradually evolved through various, what he calls, levels of being. The first one was mineral, totally dead. And gradually out of that comes a higher level of being. Now, which is called life, which is called vegetation. Now, no scientist knows, we know, vegetation or life, if matter is M, life is M plus X. But what exactly this X is, no scientist has yet been able to define. They know there is life, they know life can be killed, they know life grows, but there is no scientific formula for life. Everybody knows there is life, but a scientist has not yet been able to capture the formula for life. So life is M plus X. This is vegetation. A tree, that's almost another form of God, because compared to minerals, which can't do anything, a tree can do wonders. A tree has much more freedom than a mineral. A tree can draw its sustenance from the roots, it can carry the nutrients along the trunk, send it to the various branches and twigs, and then there blossom into flowers, and the flowers draw energy from the sun and photosynthesis, and then flowers and then fruit, and then the tree can multiply itself. Isn't this already a tremendous advance from a mineral? The mineral can't do any of these things. So, but a tree is still fixed, a tree is still limited, its consciousness is still limited. A tree becomes more divine, more godly, when out of the tree an animal comes up. An animal does everything a tree can do. It can eat, it can reproduce itself, but an animal cannot take lie quietly or dumbly any attack made on it. Trees, if you take an axe and cut its branches, the tree doesn't like it. Don't think the tree likes, is waiting to be cut. We all think the tree is waiting to be cut so that we go and cut. You know, the tree also is very sensitive. The tree also would, you know, many, there are stories in mother's lives when mother went out and saw a tree. The tree said, look, they are all planning to cut me down, but I want to live a little longer. And the mother made inquiries and sent instructions that tree should not be touched for another so many years. So trees also have this life, they have aspiration, and people have shown that if you play good music to a rose, the hues of the rose, the colors of the rose get more and more gorgeous. They like good music. If you talk to the roses in a kind of a sympathetic tone, as you talk to a human child, the rose also responds. Of course, it can't respond in a human way. It can only respond in a rose way, but it does respond. So there is something there which is other than what you find in minerals. So vegetation, then animals, which are more like God. Then, so animals are what? Animals are M plus X plus Y. What this Y is, no scientist knows. They know there is a Y. Then you come to man. Man is that part of consciousness, that aspect of consciousness which can look within. Self-scrutiny is the capacity of the human consciousness. So, that is M plus X plus Y plus Z, or Z, depending on how you pronounce it. So all this is happening, and we are, compared to God, compared to animals, more like gods. And we are more like gods. Gods are supposed to fly in the sky, we can fly in the sky. Gods are supposed to be able to dive in the seas, we can dive in the seas. Of course, there is little inconvenience of carrying the appropriate equipment, because we are not yet fully there. We need to live on food, we have to eat, we have to drink, etc. And that is why human beings, this is what Schumacher says, right from the beginning of civilization, have been dreaming of a being, of dreaming of a state when they won't need food to survive. When you are gods, would you need food to survive? I mean, if you don't do the puja and give offering to God, you mean the gods go hungry. They don't need any of these things. They don't need any physical support. So there is always this idea of more and more perfect being. And so, we already are gods, but this is not enough, as I have been telling you. This has been the theme of my talks this time, that the gods we have brought within us, the gods we have incarnated within us, have not made us less selfish, less greedy, less jealous, and all these things, gods flourish in the midst of all these things. And that is why in the world there are holocausts, in the world there are wars, in the world there are famines, in the world there are devastation of civilizations and cultures. Sometimes those who do this give very good reasons why the other guy should die. You know, they have press in their hands, they have TVs in their hands, they are opinion makers. So the injustice continues in the world. That's because the level of gods we have incarnated in our consciousness is not good enough. So we need to get into our consciousness greater gods, fuller gods. That's the meaning of evolution. Evolution is nothing but approximating the status of gods. We become more and more like gods. We already are like gods, but that's not good enough. We have to go beyond this. That's what it means to say, and being and bring down God into the lives of men. We have now brought down, the mind has brought down imperfect gods. Gods who don't think anything of exploitation, anything of taking advantage of people who are weaker than us. These are the gods we have now brought down. And as long as these are the only gods in our world, you can never dream of a better world. We need to bring down greater gods. And so, Sri Aurobindo's effort, the mother's effort was just this. They have nothing against the present gods. And as the mother said in one of her writings, if you are really on our path, and if you start getting the experience of this path, you will never be satisfied by worshipping the older gods and all these gods put together. Because you will now feel the need to turn exclusively to the gods that have yet to come down. This doesn't imply any ingratitude to the gods who have already come down. So, this is what he is saying to Savitri, that you will be able to bring these greater gods down. When all thy work in human time is done, the mind of earth shall be a home of light. The mind of earth is not yet a home of light. It is sometimes there is light and sometimes there is darkness. This darkness should be swept away. The life of earth, a tree growing towards heaven. The body of earth, a tabernacle of God. Body has yet not become a temple of God. We have not yet dedicated our body to the divine. We have said, O Lord, you can take away my soul, you can take away my mind, you can take away my heart, but don't touch my body. We have ourselves made the body untouchable. There is a spirituality of untouchability. And that spirituality of untouchability has to be given up. The body has to be brought to the front. Its claims have to be recognized. and it should be given an opportunity to participate in this yoga. And that's what he says, that's why he says, the body of earth, the tabernacle of God. There are many, many passages, I don't want to read all of them, but a few before you are ready for a well-deserved lunch. Page 700. About five lines from the top. A swimmer lost between two leaping seas, by my outer pains and inner sweetnesses, finding my joy in my opposite mysteries, thou shalt respond to me from every nerve. A vision shall compel thy coursing breath. Thy heart shall drive thee on the wheel of works. Thy mind shall urge thee through the flames of thought to meet me in the abyss and on the heights, to feel me in the tempest and the calm, and love me in the noble and the vile, in beautiful things and terrible desire. The pains of hell shall be to thee my kiss. The flowers of heaven persuade thee with my touch. This is almost ecstatic poetry, because God is very happy that finally he has found one person who is capable of receiving all that he really wants to give. And then says on page 701, last few lines, I will pour delight from thee as from a jar. He says, I will make use of you as a jar and pour delight. I shall pour delight from thee as from a jar. I will whirl thee as my chariot through the ways. I will use thee as my sword and as my lyre. I will play on thee my minstrelsies of thought. And when thou art vibrant with all ecstasy, and when thou livest one spirit with all things, then will I spare thee not my living fires, but make thee a channel for my timeless force. And Savitri, as we know, has prepared herself to be a channel for this timeless force. 705, last few, about 12 lines from the bottom. Some shall be made the glorious receptacles. You see, Sri Aurobindo never said, as a result of the descent of the supermind, everybody will immediately be transformed into a supramental being. He hasn't said that. When the mental consciousness descended, I don't know how many million years ago, not every giraffe, every monkey, every crocodile became a graduate of Harvard. They are where they are. Only some who had the urge in them, who had the capacity in them, they gradually became human. And so, this is like a ladder. You have to begin at the very bottom and slowly, through life, you have to climb the evolutionary ladder. So if God took away all the middle rungs, the ladder will be useless. So all these things are still there. There are monkeys, there are crocodiles, there are serpents, etc. They all manifest different grades of consciousness. And we have to pass through all these grades of consciousness till we become human. And even now, there is no guarantee that all human beings will eventually be supramentalized. But just as we have the mental consciousness, there must be more animals on this creation than men. This is a fair guess, right? And yet, the minority of men on this earth have been able to establish their rule, for good and for worse, for over the whole earth. Of course, we have done it in a wrong way. We have exploited nature, we have created ecological disaster, etc., etc. But notice, the mind being so powerful, It doesn't require the whole world to be mentalized. Only some part of the animal creation became mentalized. And out of these, some became scientists, some became technologists, some became empire builders. Through all these, now the mental beings more or less own this world. They decide what is to happen to this world. Similarly, when the supramental race will come, they will decide what is to happen to this world. But at that time, since they do not have the negative capacities of the mind, there won't be things like the ecological disaster. There won't be politicians who are itching for a war. There won't be people who want to impose their rule, their way of thinking over the whole world. It will be simply a different breed of people. The consciousness will be a consciousness to which love, harmony, unity, etc. will be so natural that the first impulse of these leaders of tomorrow, supramentalized leaders of tomorrow, will be, how do I share what I have with other people? Not how do I snatch at what other people have because I'm more clever. I can manipulate the markets, I can fix the level of prices, and I can impose a kind of economic imperialism on the whole world. So, this will continue. The few who have a higher consciousness will control the rest of the world, but this higher consciousness in its very nature will be of a different kind. And so, they will change the world. It doesn't have to be, everybody doesn't have to be supramentalized. And Sri Aurobindo doesn't say this is even possible. Slowly and gradually, a growing breed, a growing group of people who have done the sadhana, who have received this, will begin to control the world, and therefore the asuric forces that now interfere in the affairs of the world will be totally helpless. And the daivic forces will control the world. And this is a great future that is awaiting us. I think this is a good time for us to take a break. Tomorrow will be the last day in the morning. Any guess? We have a little bit to look at about the prophecy of the supramental age or supramental dispensation. But before that, I would like to say something, read out to you a few excerpts from Sri Aurobindo's letters. Most people, when they turn to spiritual life, have an inner feeling that they are giving up something very glorious, which is this tortured, vital, physical life, a tortured, physical, vital, mental life. Somehow, we have a feeling we are God should be grateful to us that we are turning to Him and not to this world. And this feeling comes up occasionally, sometimes frequently. And Sri Aurobindo had disciples who had written him letters suggesting this. Look, I was not just an ordinary man. I was so and so. I have given up everything and I have come here. And I have turned to the Divine, and your Divine seems to be quite cold and aloof and doesn't have any of the pleasures and the ecstasies that the worldly life offers to us. We are all like that. I mean, this is a typical letter any one of us could have written. But the man who wrote it, I suspect, was none other than Dilip Kumar Roy, so we probably couldn't have written that letter in that style. But the letter is not seen here, only Sri Aurobindo's reply. And it's a very longish kind of reply, and I think we should take a look at it, because we have sometimes feeling that the supramental world will be a world of harmony, will be a world of truth, will be a world of unity, etc., etc. But will it have any of the ecstasies that we now feel in life? True, we feel these ecstasies occasionally. These ecstasies, joys, fulfillments, etc. are often punctured, and there are long periods of the opposite of these. That's how we live through it. That's how we have in the first instance turned to the Divine. The new life that is promised, will it have anything of this ecstasy, this joy, this fulfillment, which granted in the worldly life we feel occasionally? And then of course these are occasional episodes. This was the question somebody wrote, asked Sri Aurobindo, and this is the reply he gave. It's a fairly long reply. I recommend that letter to you. This is on Letters for the Yoga, page 84 and ends on about page 92. So as you can see, it's a fairly long letter. I have no intention of reading through the whole letter. I've given you the background of it. I'll just read a little bit. Page 89. But is the divine then something so terrible, horrible, or repellent that the idea of its entry into the physical, its divinizing the human, should create this shrinking, refusal, revolt, or fear? You know, very many people feel maybe I will lose some of the felicities of ordinary life. When the divine comes, he will all transform it, but it will be as dull and as cold as the precincts of some temples. So I don't want that. I would like also life to be full and pleasant and joyous and so on. And divine, is that somehow we have a feeling that divine is a dull character. That he has, he may not be dull-witted, but dull-tempered. That's our general assumption. And therefore we feel that giving up this ordinary way of living, we are doing a great turn to the divine. The divine should be grateful to us for our starting on this. This is generally our assumption. And so Sri Aurobindo is saying, he reviews what Ramakrishna had to offer, what the Vaishnavas had to offer, what the various spiritual traditions had to offer. And now he comes to what he has to offer, where the divine comes down all the way into your physical and transforms it. I can understand that the unregenerate vital, attached to its own petty sufferings and pleasures, to the chief ignorant drama of life, should shrink from what will change it. But why should a God-lover, a God-seeker, a sadhak fear the divinization of consciousness? Why should he object to become one in nature with what he seeks? Why should he recoil from sadrishya mukti, which means being like God in our nature? Behind this fear, there are usually two causes. First, there is the feeling of the vital that it will have to cease to be obscure, crude, muddy, egoistic, unrefined. We all take some joy, some delight in remaining obscure, crude, muddy, egoistic and unrefined, full of stimulating desires and small pleasures and interesting sufferings. Your life is full of these small pleasures and interesting sufferings, for it shrinks even from the ananda which will replace this. We compare to this decoction of pleasures and suffering, etc., that we go through. Pure ananda is something that we tend to shrink away from. Next, there is some vague, ignorant idea of the mind, due, I suppose, to the ascetic tradition, that the divine nature is something cold, bare, empty, austere, aloof, without the glorious riches of the egoistic human vital life. This is our fear, that we may not get any of these enjoyments, as if there were not a divine vital. So what Sri Aurobindo says, you have a human vital and there is a divine vital. The only difference is, human vital is a changeful thing. It's punctuated by periods and moods of fulfillment, periods and moods of disappointment. But the divine vital is so powerful that there will be no disappointments. It will be one constant experience of joy. And what we are saying is, because we have uncertain pleasures in the vital stage, we are afraid to lose it without realizing. If we lose this and get the divinized vital, we will be always in a mood of fulfillment. That's what he's saying. As if there were not a divine vital, and as if that divine vital is not itself, and when it gets the means to manifest, will not make the life on earth almost also infinitely more full of beauty, love, radiance, warmth, fire, intensity and divine passion and capacity for bliss than the present, impotent, suffering, pettily and transiently excited and soon tired vitality of the still so imperfect human creation. This is a very grand, great letter. We must all get it printed out and put a copy in the kitchen, one on the dining room table, etc. He says, look, these are all full of pleasures, but these are such petty pleasures, such transient pleasures, that we all know they just pass, and we do not have the capacity to eat a full meal as you, as we are. The divine vital doesn't have any of these weaknesses. It is, as he says, full of beauty, love, radiance, warmth, fire, intensity and divine passion and capacity for bliss, that much more than the present, impotent, suffering, pettily and transiently excited and soon tired vitality of the still so imperfect human creation. But you will say that it is not the divine from which you recoil. Rather, you accept and ask for it, but what you object to is the supramental, grand, aloof, incomprehensible, unapproachable, a sort of austere, nirakara Brahman. People have an idea, well, I can understand if you attain the divine vital, you know, you can be like Lord Krishna, for example. But supramental isn't anything like that. We have a feeling that it is cold and aloof like nirakara Brahman. The supramental, so described, is a bogey created by this part of your vital mind in order to frighten itself and justify its attitude. See, there is no such supramental which is cold and aloof and grand, etc. It is something that your mind itself has created in order to justify its clinging to the present state. Behind this strange description, there seems to be an idea that the supramental is a new version of the Vedantic featureless and incommunicable Parabrahman, vast, grand, cold, empty, remote, devastating, overwhelming. It is not quite that. Of course, since it can come down, but for all practical purposes, it is just as bad. That's what we think. So this super mind is as bad as this nirakara Brahman. It is curious that you admit your ignorance of what the supermental can be, and yet you, in these moods, not only pronounce categorically what it is like, but reject emphatically my experience about it as of no practical validity and not valid for anybody but myself. He says, you say you don't know what the supramental is like, but then you go ahead and reject everything that I have experienced, as if, you know, I experienced something imaginary. I have not insisted. I have answered only casually, because I am not asking you now to be non-human and divine, much less to be supramental. But as you are always returning to this point, when you have these attacks of, you know, depression or doubt, you know, people have this, and then they weave out theories why supramental only can be a bogus thing. And so people wrote about the such fears to Sri Aurobindo. He says, since you have been writing to me about this, the supramental, he says, is not grand, aloof, cold and austere. He says, as far as I have experienced the supramental, it is not something grand or cold or aloof or austere. It is not something opposed to or inconsistent with a full vital and physical manifestation. On the contrary, it carries in it the only possibility of the fullness of the vital force and the physical life on earth. On earth, if you want to experience the fullness of a vital life, the fullness of physical life on earth, it can only be done on the basis of a supramental consciousness. It is because it is so, because it was so revealed to me, and for no other reason that I have followed after it and persevered till I came into contact with it and was able to draw down some power of it and its influence. I myself was fascinated by the fulfillment the supramental consciousness gives to all our aspirations, the vital and physical. And then he announces, I am concerned with the earth and not with worlds beyond for their own sake. It's a terrestrial realization that I seek and not a flight to distant summits. All other yogas regard this life as an illusion or a passing phase. The supramental yoga alone regards it as a thing created by the divine for a progressive manifestation and takes the fulfillment of the life and the body for its object. Just consider this, fulfillment of the life of the vital and the physical as the object of my yoga. The supramental is simply the truth consciousness, and what it brings in its descent is the full truth of life, the full truth of the consciousness in matter. One has indeed to rise to high summits to reach it, but the more one rises, the more one can bring it down below. No doubt, life and body have not to remain the ignorant, imperfect, impotent things they are now. But why should I change to fuller life power, fuller body power, be considered something aloof, cold and undesirable? The utmost ananda the body and life are now capable of is a brief excitement to the vital mind or the nerves or the cells, which is limited, imperfect and soon passes. With the supramental change, all the cells, nerves, vital forces, embodied mental forces can become filled with a thousandfold ananda, capable of an intensity of bliss which passes description and which need not fade away. How aloof, repellent and undesirable. You call this repellent, undesirable, aloof? That's what he's saying. The supramental now means an intense unity of soul with soul, mind with mind, life with life, and an entire flooding of the body consciousness with the physical experience of oneness, the presence of the beloved in every part, in every cell of the body. Have you ever even imagined this kind of fulfillment of physical consciousness? Have you ever imagined this kind of fulfillment for love? That he says, you know, what is it that we know of love? What is it that we know of bliss that you complain against the supramental fulfillment? You have so far enjoyed or experienced nothing. What the supramental promises is thousandfold in intensity, in permanence, in its delight, in its power. And so, is that too something aloof and grand and undesirable? With the supramental change, the very thing on which you insist, the possibility of the free physical meeting of the embodied divine with the sadhak, without conflict of forces and without undesirable reactions, becomes possible, assured and free. That too, I suppose, is something aloof and undesirable. I could go on for pages, but this is enough for the instrument. And Shurbindu says it is such a small, narrow part of the fulfillment that body is capable of feeling, that you are making a small thing and said, can it have, you know, like, it's like a frog in a well. You know, it seemed, you know, the story of the frog in a well met a frog from the sea. You know, they met once together. And the frog from the sea, they were describing the vastness of the sea, and the frog in the well wouldn't know how vast is vast. So he said, is your sea as vast as this, and jump 5 feet, is it as vast? No, it's much vaster, 10 feet. No, it's much vaster, 15 feet. No, much vaster, there can't be anything as vast beyond this well, that's what we think. This is our understanding of the supramental and its fulfillment. And so when you read it in poetry, Sri Aurobindo hasn't described it in great detail anywhere. And so he hasn't made much advertisement on, there is no brochure out yet on the supramental. What kind of housing will be available, what kind of food arrangements will be available, what kind of, travel facilities will be available, nothing is out. There is in the Life Divine, in part 1, there is a chapter 24, I think, it's called The Knot of Matter, where Sri Aurobindo talks about the fundamental characteristics of matter, what these are, and also discusses them in such a way that you will see its limitations of matter. The God of Death has not yet read that chapter completely. So, this is what is creating this problem. And I will try to review that chapter briefly here for our purposes, so that you have a background.